It's Wednesday, December 3rd, 2008, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers. Welcome to the podcast and welcome to the middle of the week. I wonder how many of you caught that documentary last night on the National Geographic Channel, the one with Lisa Ling called Marijuana Nation, had its premiere last night. And yeah, I saw this video and I've got most of my thoughts about it posted up on the blog at stash.normal.org. I thought all in all it wasn't bad. There were some pretty glaring errors and assumptions and drug war propaganda that weren't properly rebutted, but it did spend pretty much equal time between the law enforcement side and the medical marijuana side and the cannabis culture side to some extent. I guess my biggest complaint about it was the lack of any drug law reform voices in the video. No Keith Stropp or Alan St. Pierre, no Rob Campia, no Ethan Nadelman, or any number of people I could mention who would have debunked some of those assumptions and propaganda and would have focused a little bit better on marijuana prohibition. You know, what is the ill effects of the prohibition itself, which was kind of glossed over in the documentary. But all in all, like I said, for a mainstream marijuana documentary, not too bad. I guess I'd give it about a B-. Now, coming up on the Stash today, speaking of documentaries, we're going to be speaking with John Holowack, who is the director, producer, writer of the DVD High, The True Tale of American Marijuana, which we told you about last week. And you can pick it up at the regular online outlets like Amazon.com, but also you can check the main website, which is at truehigh.com. That's truehigh.com. And since it is Wednesday, we will be having our visit from Dr. Mitch Earlywine with a dose of cannabis science. Today we're going to be talking about the gateway theory, the idea that marijuana could lead to meth, as a billboard here in my hometown has recently proclaimed. We'll be debunking that once again with Dr. Mitch. The good doctor is also going to give us some tips on how to avoid packing on any unnecessary pounds when the munchies collide with the holiday treats. So you'll want to hear that. We've also got our regular hemp headlines, including probably the funniest headline I've read all year, and our musical break, just enough to get you through a hump day. So sit back and relax and enjoy your normal daily audio stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Washington, D.C. settles in death of paralyzed medical marijuana patient Jonathan Magbe. From the Washington Post. The mother of a quadriplegic inmate who died in 2004 after suffering breathing problems at the D.C. jail, has reached financial settlements with the district government and his care providers, her attorneys disclosed yesterday. The settlements were reached in the controversial death of Jonathan Magbe, a 27-year-old Maryland man who was paralyzed from the neck down and used a mouth-operated wheelchair. Magbe died 4 days into a 10-day jail sentence for possessing marijuana, which he said he used to ease the discomfort caused by his disability. The jail infirmary, where he was housed for several days, wasn't equipped with the ventilator he needed to breathe at night. Magbe's ordeal began September 20, 2004, when D.C. Superior Court Judge Judith E. Retchen sentenced him to jail after he pleaded guilty to possessing marijuana. D.C. police found a gun and marijuana in Magbe's pockets in April 2003 after stopping a vehicle driven by a cousin of his. Magbe admitted buying the marijuana, records show. Magbe's mother was furious that the judge did not give her son probation, the typical punishment for first-time offenders. Magbe, paralyzed since being hit by a drunk driver at age 4, had no criminal record. Retchen told a judicial commission that she sentenced Magbe to jail because he said he would continue to smoke marijuana to alleviate his pain. She also told the commission that she was unaware that he needed a ventilator to breathe at night. The commission cleared Retchen of wrongdoing. Judge Judith Retchen killed Jonathan Magbe just as surely as if she had put a plastic bag over his head. How do you look at a paralyzed man in pain and decide that keeping him locked up without pain medicine is just the sort of incentive he needs to stop taking his pain medicine? Magbe's only crime was being honest to the judge about his medical use. Had he lied and told her he'd never touch the demon reefers again, his lack of a criminal record and disability would have gotten him probation, and he'd be alive today. It should be noted that the people of Washington, D.C., by a 69% majority, approved a measure to allow medical marijuana use. I guess that means that Bob Barr also helped kill Jonathan Magbe, since he authored the Barr Amendment that killed D.C.'s medical marijuana initiative. And the congressmen who approved it by voice vote are accomplices. Marijuana decriminalization in Massachusetts presenting logistical hurdles. From the Belmont Citizen Herald. Boston, Massachusetts. State and county law enforcement officials are encountering major obstacles in trying to implement the voter-approved decriminalization of less than an ounce of marijuana, with a month remaining before the new law takes effect. Governor Deval Patrick's top public safety aide has been working with district attorneys to conceive the tools necessary to enforce the voter mandate, which imposes civil rather than criminal penalties. But law enforcement officials call the law such a drastic shift from current policies that assembling the implementation package is nearly impossible given the time frame. The legislature, which has no formal session scheduled before the law is due to take effect in early January, appears unlikely to make changes to the new law before then. Training police, developing an education program for juveniles arrested for possession, issuing civil citations, and working with schools and colleges to align anti-pot rules have all proved problematic for Patrick administration officials as they hold meetings with officials from several administration agencies and law enforcement. Williams said police groups have questioned whether officers would be subject to civil action if they arrest someone in possession of a quantity of marijuana that is later found to be less than an ounce, or whether officers would be permitted to search a vehicle if they saw a marijuana cigarette or joint as allowed under current law. Hold on, let me get out the world's tiniest violin so we may play a mournful tune for the poor public officials in Massachusetts who have been so suddenly blindsided by marijuana decriminalization that they have no working plan on how to implement the law. I wonder how much of that time that they spent organizing against the ballot initiative could have been spent on preparing for its eventual passage. 'Cause it's kind of funny, 'cause I've been following this thing since February. It's even funnier that the legislature held a hearing on the initiative in March. It's funnier still that it was polling at 72% in August. And even funnier when you consider that cities like Amherst and many others made pot their lowest law enforcement priority by large voting majorities. So it's not like this initiative passing should have caught anyone by surprise. Here's an idea. If you want to know how cops will have to behave in a decriminalized state, ask some in the other 12 decriminalized states. It's not like Massachusetts now has to reinvent the wheel. We decriminalized marijuana in Oregon 35 years ago. Ask us. Texas man gets 7 years for child pot smoking videotape. From the Dallas Morning News. One of two men videotaped last year giving pot to young children accepted a plea deal Tuesday and was sentenced to 7 years in prison, saving himself from a possible life sentence. Van Swan Pulte, age 20, of Fort Worth, pleaded guilty to 2 counts of injury to a child causing bodily harm and 3 counts of burglary of a habitation. He was to face 2 charges of injury to a child for giving a marijuana cigar to 2- and 4-year-old brothers at a later time, prosecutors said. Investigators said Mr. Pulte was a teen in early 2007 when he and a friend, Demetrius McCoy, urged the youngsters to smoke marijuana at Mr. McCoy's Watauga home. Mr. Pulte and Mr. McCoy, the boy's uncle, came to the attention of police who were investigating a string of residential burglaries in Watauga, Fort Worth, and Blue Mound. The videotape was uncovered during that investigation. In addition to prompting the boys to smoke the drug-laden cigar, Mr. Pulte and Mr. McCoy could also be seen and heard on the tape laughing and calling the tots potheads. At the time of the incident, the boy's mother, Shatoria Russell, was asleep in a nearby room. Ms. Russell has since tested positive for drugs and relinquished custody of her boys, a CPS official said. The children are in foster care and will be placed for adoption. Now, we covered this story on the Stash a few months ago, and I'll say it again. It is reprehensible that anyone would force a 2- and 4-year-old to smoke anything. That said, those kids suffered far less damage from those few puffs off a blunt than if they had been raised by a tobacco smoker who smokes indoors. And yet, I don't think I've ever heard of a case where someone was charged with injury to a child causing bodily harm for their secondhand tobacco smoke. Though my Googling did find child custody cases where a judge considered tobacco smoking as a factor. YouTube videos of cute youngsters running around the living room while the parent smokes a cigarette also never become viral hits on the internet. Hey, thanks everyone, and welcome back to the Normal Daily Audio Stash Awards. And the award for the funniest headline of the day goes to the Philippine Star. MILF growing marijuana to sustain operations. From the Philippine Star. The Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or MILF, has ventured into the illegal drug trade to sustain its operations, Dangerous Drug Board Chair Vicente Tito Sato III said yesterday. Citing intelligence information, Sato said members of the rebel group are protecting marijuana plantations in the Lanao and Bukidnon provinces. Sato explained, quote, "This is what we call narco-terrorism, where Moro rebels engage in illegal drug trade to fund their operations. This poses big danger, especially to younger generations," end quote. Okay, so MILF doesn't mean the same thing there as it does here in America. When I first scanned the headline in my marijuana news feed, I thought, well, sure, who can blame a mom for selling pot to pay for operations? Plastic surgery is expensive. Well, seriously, though, one might ask Tito Sotto why the MILF doesn't just sell alcohol or cigarettes to sustain its operations. Regulate marijuana, and you take a big chunk of business away from what you call narco-terrorism.
Hello, Chicago!
Barack Obama has been elected the 44th president of the United States. But will he bring us, the cannabis community,
the change we can believe in?
It's an issue of doctors prescribing medical marijuana. I think that should be appropriate.
Normal is asking you to take action and help us hold President-elect Obama to his word with our $10,000 pro-cannabis law reform ad contest.
When I was a kid, I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Just make a 30 or 60 second video or flash animation that answers the question, what should President Obama do about pot? You can submit as many entries as you like, and winning videos will be featured on Normal's website and television campaigns.
What I'm not going to be doing is using Justice Department resources to try to circumvent state laws on this issue.
The grand prize is $3,500, so enter early and enter often.
Well, I would not punish doctors if it's prescribed. That may require some changes in federal law.
Contest deadline is January 15, 2009. Check norml.org for official contest rules.
The war on drugs has been a utter failure, and I think that we need to rethink and decriminalize our marijuana laws.
President Obama, we couldn't agree more.
Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid, and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with Normal's look at cannabis science. Time for another dose of cannabis science. We're joined again, all the way from New York, by Dr. Mitch Earlywine, a associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York in Albany. And Dr. Earlywine, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm hoping you're having a good holiday season. How was Thanksgiving for you?
Oh, splendid. Splendid.
Lots to be thankful for, especially with a couple of the court decisions we've seen recently. But what I wanted to talk to you about today was something, we've debunked this so many times, the so-called gateway theory. But it popped up again right near my hometown. I've got a post up on the stash about this billboard that's funded by one of our local anti-drug groups. And it says, marijuana, a gateway drug to meth. And then it's got the picture of the guy smoking a joint on one side. Then they got the pockmarked, meth addict on the other side. And I just thought, we should bring you back on to, so we can tell people the true facts and the real research behind this so-called gateway theory.
I'm happy to discuss it. And we've talked about it before. My friend Ralph Tarter at the University of Pittsburgh has data following folks up over 10 years and some of them even more, showing that, use of cannabis, even heavy use early in life, does not guarantee any kind of use of hard illicit drugs. In truth, some analyses I did years ago suggested that even if you had used cannabis, your chances of using cocaine were less than 1 in 100 and probably closer to 1 in 300.
Mm.
And when you just start looking at the data from just big national drug surveys, we don't have a lot on meth, but heroin, for example, we've got, over 100 million people who've probably tried cannabis in their lives and fewer than 6 million who've used heroin. So obviously there really isn't much of a gateway. People seem to get confused because we tend to remember examples that fit our stereotypes and forget the ones that don't. So anytime you find somebody who is a heroin addict and ask, did you ever smoke pot, we seem to remember those. The folks who do have problems with hard drugs who haven't used marijuana often either don't end up in these studies or we just tend to forget about them.
Hmm.
So one of the big studies that came out around 2005 on this anybody who had used a hard drug before marijuana, they kicked them out of the sample. So, of course, there was not going to be any evidence against the gateway under those kinds of circumstances. And these studies tend to be really biased against that. And particularly with this one where meth is the issue, my goodness, you know, meth has enough negative consequences on its own that ought to be played up rather than somehow trying to drag marijuana in with a drug that's clearly got a markedly higher dependence potential and a whole lot of horrid negative health consequences.
Mm. Yeah, I've got a theory about this, and I just wanted to get your input on it, too, that here in Oregon, you know, we've got a pretty successful medical marijuana program, and about 8% of our population uses marijuana compared to a national average of about 6%, or depending on which, you know, research you're looking at. So we do tend to have more marijuana users, and it tends to have more marijuana acceptance. On the other hand, out in the rural areas of Oregon, there's a huge problem with meth. We see stories on the news all the time of, you know, the meth people stealing the steel off of bridges and such. So my theory here is that they know they can't convince us that marijuana is as bad as they say it is, so they've got to compare it to meth to put some sort of, you know, spookiness on it, I guess. Do you think that's what's going on?
Absolutely, and in fact, this goes back to the 1930s when old Harry Anslinger was our first drug czar, when it was still the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and he said, oh, marijuana leads to heroin use. The LaGuardia reports that came out in the 1940s suggested this really isn't the case at all. We're talking 60, 70 years ago. We already knew this was wrong, but this is all that folks can come up with anymore to try to make this happen. You can see it's really an absurd argument. And in fact, when you talk to regular users of cannabis, they tend to dislike hard drugs because, you know, cannabis is really providing the kind of experience that they want, and these other drugs really don't create anywhere near the same kind of effect.
Yeah, it's like Alan St. Pierre often says that rather than being a gateway, it seems like marijuana is almost a terminus sort of drug.
Well, and the curious thing is, it's very hard to get these published, but, you know, we hear time and again cases of folks who've had problems with alcohol or hard drugs turning to cannabis because it has, you know, really markedly fewer negative consequences and arguably none at all. And, what a surprise, they don't have to hit these hard drugs, if they've got, you know, regular access to clean and appropriate cannabis.
Well, yeah, I've known a few people who have struggled with methamphetamine addiction, and just anecdotally, they've told me that had it not been for cannabis, they don't think they could have kicked or could have gotten off of it. But you say, is there any research on that? Is there anybody that's willing to step forward and do the research on that idea about cannabis?
As you can imagine, these kinds of things are very difficult to get funding
for. Yeah.
And the individual case studies are very hard to publish, so everybody sort of brushes it aside as saying, oh, this is just an individual case, it doesn't seem to work. But I've had therapists literally from one end of the country to the other tell me that they've got clients who've succeeded along these lines, and folks who've emailed me time and again saying that this has really been helpful for them. It's unfortunate because people have become more open-minded with things like methadone as a replacement for heroin, or pharmaceutical drugs that people are prescribing in an effort to get folks off prescription stimulants or, you know, illicit stimulants. But for some reason, the notion that cannabis might actually be an aid to this has really become controversial. I just sent in my latest book on substance abuse treatment alluding to this idea, and I'm eager to see if my editors try to cut it.
You know, that'll be nice to see. And it kind of also goes back to that Swiss vote that we just saw this week, where the Swiss people voted to make permanent their heroin maintenance program at the same time they voted against decriminalizing cannabis. And my thought was, you know, decriminalize the cannabis, you'll have less heroin addicts. Maybe.
It's so funny how that resistance is still there. And that program has been just wonderfully successful and really turned some lives around, saved literally millions of dollars in just emergency room visits and ODs and just all kinds of wild negative health consequences. And yet the resistance to decriminalizing was still there. I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, very, very strange. Now, as I was writing up the post on this, I, of course, had to go out and get some of the links to, of course, the Institute of Medicine from 1999 on this whole gateway theory. And I got this really interesting quote from them where they say, in fact, most drug users begin with alcohol and nicotine before marijuana, usually before they're of legal age. And that is also backed up from a 2003 quote I found in the Journal of the American Medical Association saying that early regular use of tobacco and alcohol emerged as the two factors most consistently associated with later illicit drug use and abuse or dependence. So I'm wondering then, Doctor, why don't they say alcohol and tobacco are the gateway drugs?
The funny thing is, Russ, my friend Linda Collins at Penn State has data suggesting that little kids who drink a lot of caffeine are actually the ones who may be at greatest risk for developing drug problems later on. And I think what this says is it's not really the drugs that do this, it's that there's a subset of folks who just love to do everything. And I'm afraid we all know those people, and what a surprise they do end up running into problems. But it says a lot more about people than it does about drugs.
So we've got the facts on our side on this. It looks like the research has been done, and all the serious researchers, you know, believe there's really no such thing as this gateway effect. What are we going to do to get this through people's heads, you know, in the public mind, to convince them that this gateway theory is bunk?
This is actually a really common error that people make in logic, where they think if something comes before something else, it's the cause of something else. And I'm afraid I teach this to my four-year-old with the classic game of pull my finger. You know, it's just because something happened first doesn't mean it's a cause. And I feel like we have to keep giving examples like this time and again. The number of churches in a city and the amount of crime in a city tend to co-vary. And in fact, that doesn't mean churches cause crime. You know, we just have to really keep using these outrageous examples until people finally get it through their heads that this is the same messed up logic as we have in pull my finger or in the idea that churches cause crime.
Yeah, I think also what hurts people in trying to uncover the lie behind it is the fact that marijuana is illegal, and since it's illegal and the other drugs are illegal, they figure all illegal kind of goes together. You know, if we can kind of separate their minds from the illegality of it and look at the causes, you know, that the drug itself does not cause the use of another drug, I think that's where we're going to have to go with that.
Well, and in fact, we saw in some of the early data from the Netherlands, when they separated the cannabis market from the hard drug market, they did see drops in hard drug use. And I think that in some ways is saying if there was any kind of gateway, it was that people were going to the illicit market as a whole and getting these hard drugs presented to them in a way that was, you know, a product of being in the underground market. Whereas if we had a separate tax and regulated market for cannabis, obviously folks could get that without having exposure to meth and drugs that have, you know, some really harsh problems associated with their use.
Yeah, or as I like to say, you know, marijuana is not a gateway to hard drugs. Marijuana is a gateway to hard drug dealers.
Exactly. Very well put. And then people tend to forget the, you know, folks like Allen Ginsberg, who shot heroin first and then used cannabis, and he said, yep, heroin, it's a gateway drug.
Well, Dr. Leewine, thanks for joining us. And before we go, you know, we just got through the Thanksgiving season, and of course, Christmas is coming up. And, you know, those of us in the cannabis community already have somewhat of a battle with what we call the munchies. And of course, holiday, the munchies are very, very fat and calorie laden. So any tips on helping us get through these holiday seasons and staying in the same pants or dress size?
The impact of cannabis on appetite is very real, as folks who saw Carl Hart's presentation at the Normal Conference in October realize, yes, indeed, if you are using cannabis, you do tend to consume more calories. The big picture on this, of course, is there's an opportunity to wait until after you've eaten in order to go ahead and fire up the vaporizer, and I think that can be really adaptive for a lot of folks. The other thing that's really a wonderful lesson of this plan is let's really pay attention to our food under the circumstances. Take bites about the size of your thumbnail, tend to really relish them, enjoy them, talk about them with your friends, how good the food tastes, rather than just woofing it down in front of the TV, and what a surprise you find, you enjoy the meal more and actually consume less. It takes a while for your brain to register that your stomach's actually full, and so we need to sort of spread the meal out a little bit and give yourself a little bit of time. Some adaptive things that a colleague of mine, Drew Anderson here, who studies eating, has found is that basically if you put a little bit on your plate, walk away from the big table, eat that little bit, and then make it so you have to decide to actually get up and go get more before you do, people tend to consume less. And it's an amazing opportunity to see how if you quit a little bit before you actually feel full, you find you don't feel completely nauseated later on.
Those are good tips for any time of the year, but especially the holidays. And I guess my tip would be get yourself one of those gas mask bongs. It's really hard to eat when those are strapped on. Dr. Leewine, thanks for joining us again here on the Daily Audio Stash. We'll talk to you next week.
Looking forward to it.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org.
I always get confused by drinking and smoking references. I know you can get buzzed from drinking, but does it refer to smoking too? I'm sure someone has felt buzzed while smoking. I know that you can't feel blazed while drinking, but you can feel blazed from smoking. I know I should stop worrying about this, but I can't help it. And Russ just told me that you can get buzzed from smoking anyway. So, I thought I would continue this rocking week by featuring Ape House, a power pop foursome from Washington, D.C. Are You Buzzed features the simple power chord structure that made bands like Weezer and Fountains of Wayne famous. They formed in 2001 and have been rocking the District of Columbia ever since. You can hear more of their music on their MySpace page or through their website, which we have linked at our blog at stash.normal.org. And without further ado, here is Ape House with Are You Buzzed?
Support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORMAL. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORMAL, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Well, last week on the NORMAL Daily Audio Stash, we told you about the premiere of a new cannabis documentary called High, The True Tale of American Marijuana, and we're joined now by the writer, director, producer, and chief bottle washer from the movie, John Holowack. And John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you put the movie together, written, directed, produced. About how long did this take out of your life?
It's been about 5 years now. And the whole time I've been, it wasn't just me, it was mostly me and my producer, Bob Shubring, who really believed in the project from the beginning. When I just posted a message about it on an IMDb Pro board, and he wanted to get involved, and he's been with me ever since. And in July we got the distribution for it, and now it's out. So.
Well, that's excellent. Where can people catch the movie right now?
Right now you can get it on Amazon, Netflix, Best Buy Online, Blockbuster Online. It'll be coming out in Hollywood Video and iTunes soon, just trying to get it as many places as possible. Mostly you can find out where it's at from the official website.
All right, check out the website. That's out at truehigh.com. That's TrueHigh.com. And John, you know, there's a good number of documentaries out there on marijuana, the war on drugs, and so on. What did you try to do with this movie to make it different, make it stand out from the other marijuana documentaries out there?
I think a lot of the marijuana documentaries are very sort of, I guess, stoner docs. They're towards people who smoke marijuana who are already going to agree with them and agree with their positions. I wanted to try and make something that could cross that barrier to other people who didn't know much about the drug war or the war on drugs, and also not just focus solely on marijuana, but on the other issues like pain medication and the DEA raiding these people, arresting doctors, those kinds of issues that would cross over to even people who smoke marijuana didn't even know about.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I liked about the movie is how you show that the war on marijuana is something that's kind of separate and distinct from the other parts of the war on drugs, since we have the issues of medical marijuana and so on. And yet the war on marijuana is the underpinning of the entire war on drugs. Expand on that just a little bit, if you would.
Absolutely. Half of the federal anti-drug budget goes towards marijuana, eradicating marijuana, raiding clinics, propaganda campaigns from the ONDCP and organizations like that. Half of it goes towards marijuana. If you eliminated that from the equation, then it would affect all the other areas of the war on drugs, which is, I think most people would agree that something like crystal meth and really hard, dangerous drugs are probably, most people would agree with eradicating or trying to remove the use of that. But what we're doing right now is not effective in accomplishing those goals either. And it gets bogged down under marijuana prohibition because that gets the majority of the focus from both government campaigns and that gets the majority of the focus from the government campaigns and from the DEA, all those government organizations. And so people don't really look closer at other ways we could be stopping the harder, dangerous drug use that we really should, and just leave people who smoke marijuana alone.
Yeah, I agree with that, of course, and I think you make a really good point about that, about how the drug war does get bogged down in the ineffective prohibition of marijuana. We're looking at this Friday, December 5th, we're having it's the 75th anniversary of the repeal of alcohol prohibition, which got repealed because people realized it just wasn't working, and the collateral damage from it was worse than the drug itself. And That was another
thing.
Yeah, that was another thing I wanted to bring up about your film, that there was a point in the film that just really, really catches the viewer, just really just kind of, it's a punch to the gut. And that's the series of scenes you had from the correctional facility with the supposed training video. I was wondering how you got that video, and maybe if you could tell people a little about it and how the war on drugs is so dehumanizing to so many people.
Well, the prison footage was from this county, Brazoria County in Texas. And what it was a private prison facility run by a company called CCRI, Capital Correctional Resources Incorporated. And they kind of did the overflow from other states that couldn't hold prisoners. And you see a lot of these private prison companies and things springing up right there. And what happened was there were these prisoners from Missouri who had come in not that long ago. They weren't suspected of anything, of trafficking or drug use or whatever, but this sort of raid happened inside the prison. And it was between the guards from the private prison company and the local sheriff's deputies. And it's even impossible to try and describe it without seeing it. Just crawling around on the floor like dogs, stripping naked in front of one another, being strip searched, just really horrible, demoralizing things, and just shouting at them. This one point, there's a guy who he has one leg, and he's supposed to be crawling on the floor, and he's screaming, "I only got one leg! I got one leg!" And they're just dragging him along the floor, and then one of the guards, or possibly one of the police officers, says, "I only got one dick."
Like, oh. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is rather. It's some of the most, disturbing footage I've seen in a documentary in a while. But I think it's a good thing that it's there, because it kind of, slaps the viewer into understanding that, not only, the drug czar likes to say it's not the same pot as it was in the 60s. Well, it's not the same type of prohibition either. It's become militarized, and these tactics they're using are dehumanizing and just awful. And I'm glad you showed that. I'm really glad.
And I think that this isn't really included in the movie, but I think the work of Radley Bolko,
yes,
who runs this blog of The Agitator, he's really been focused on the militarization of the drug war, especially with no-knock entry, which mostly has to do with the war on drugs. And it's with SWAT teams, the increasing militarization of the police in relationship to the war on drugs, because they get money specifically to do this. There was this... And you find a lot of the time that a lot of collateral damage from that as well, unsurprisingly. People who are woken up in the middle of the night by, men dressed completely in black holding guns to them, they freak out, they have a gun, they try to shoot them, they get shot themselves, or if they happen to shoot the intruder, they don't know who they are, then they are prosecuted for shooting a police officer when they didn't even know it was happening, when there could be certainly better ways of doing it. If you're going to arrest a suspect, do it when he's on the way to work, or when he's just left the house or something like that. Don't break into the house in the middle of the night and try and take him when he doesn't even know what's happening. And I think that's just part of the militarization. It's happening all over the place. And as for the prison video, the you said it was a training video, and that was perhaps the most disturbing part for me. The reason they did this, the reason they had them strip search and crawling along the floor and all this, was because they wanted to show police officers how they wanted to search people who were suspected of possessing drugs. Not just prisoners, but anyone in the general population. This is what the mindset is, this absurdist kind of idea of how people should be treated because they want to put a certain this or that inside their body. I think it's shameful and disgusting.
Yeah. And the documentary covers a lot of these angles in the drug war. It covers the medical marijuana angle. It covers the recreational use and so on. And we see a lot of these documentaries, especially people that are going to listen to this podcast are pretty well versed on the issue. Did you find anything in your studies and research and filming of this film that caught you by surprise, that you didn't realize about the drug war, that might surprise our listeners?
Quite a few things. First of all, I hadn't realized much about needle sharing programs and needle exchange programs. As the most surprising statistic that I found in all the research was that New York had implemented needle exchange and legal pharmacy sales of needles without prescriptions, and they saw the HIV infection rate in IV drug users drop by half, fully half, of the previous infection rate. And, you know, most people would say, like, well, who cares about IV drug users, which is whatever. But the thing is that most people don't understand that the HIV from the IV drug-using population spreads to the general population. It happens in increasingly greater numbers in places like Russia. I think the numbers are 73% of new HIV infections come from the IV drug-using population and then spread into the general population. So we can't just ignore that segment of the population and write them off and think that it can't be useful. But if we can drop that number by half for that entire population, that'd be a huge victory in the fight against HIV. But the current administration, and maybe the next administration, I don't know, are opposing needle exchange programs and things like that, saying that are opposing needle exchange and sharing programs, saying that it sends a bad message. And I thought to myself, well, someone dying alone in an alleyway of AIDS isn't a message. They're a person. They shouldn't be subject to this sort of moralizing when we have something that we know works and that we know can be effective in reducing this deadly disease.
Yeah.
So that was the most surprising thing to me, how it's just a complete disconnect between what I think is a better moral position versus their strict moral position.
Yeah, we just had a vote in Switzerland where the people there approved making their needle maintenance program permanent by a vote of about 68%. So there are places in the world where they're realizing that it really does work. We're just not one of them.
Absolutely, absolutely. But even worse, the government tends to try and affect, because of course we're big world power, although with the economy, not so much anymore. But we have been strong-arming other countries into not implementing different needle exchange programs. Countries that are in a weak economic position and kind of rely on the United States for trade or what have you, we can just go to them, well, you know, something might happen if you do this. And they're like, all right, well. So I think it's not only us playing with people's lives here, it's us playing with people's lives all over the world, which I think is capricious and very unfair.
Yeah. Well, folks, you can learn all about it in the documentary High, The True Tale of American Marijuana. It's out on DVD now through all the usual online outlets, as well as the website, the official site at truehigh.com, TRUEHIGH.com. John Holowack is the director and producer and writer, and thanks for joining us today on the Daily Audio Stash, John.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and I hope more people hear about this.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes. This one's a bit more reefer madness from 1929 from Colonel Levi G. Nutt, who was the head of the Narcotics Division of the U.S. Treasury Department. He said, quote,
"I'd rather see my children up against a wall and see them shot down before my eyes than to know that any one of them was going to be a drug slave."
End quote. Well, Colonel, that's quite the reaction. I'm kind of curious to see what your children thought of that idea. It might be kind of interesting to follow up on the Nutt family to find out what actually did happen to some of his children. Wouldn't it be ironic if some of them turned out to be massive stoners? I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here for the podcast. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews you can use. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.